I first saw him outside the window, looking in at me, not one bit sure if he wanted me there or not. He was very handsome, with thick, dark hair. I made eye contact with him and held it to let him know that yes, I could see him perfectly, and no, he couldn't frighten me away. Then I simply said, "Come in." Suddenly he was standing in front of me, taller and broader than I first thought. He was holding a scythe with a rough wooden handle, its long crescent blade looking old and used but still sharp enough to do serious damage. I refused to react to it, just continued making eye contact with him, and either he respected me for it, or he was relieved that finally, after a long, long time, someone wasn't shrieking at him to get away. He gave an almost courtly nod. "My name is Giovanni," he said. "What's yours?" I told him, then asked what he was doing there. He spoke in a clear, quiet voice. "I'm sad because my wife is gone." The instant those words came out of his mouth, I was flooded with a rapid-fire montage of images in what seemed like less than a second. Another bed in this same room. A dark-haired man in the bed, not Giovanni, but resembling him. A dark-haired woman in the bed with him, both of them sleeping. Giovanni, eyes vacant, advancing toward the bed, the scythe raised high above his head. "Giovanni, did you kill someone?" I asked. He began to weep. "It was wrong what my brother Anthony did. I brought Maria here from Italy to be my wife, and while I was out in the hot fields, they were in here making love. I made them both sorry that they did this to Giovanni." "After you killed them, what did you do next?" "I ran away," he confessed. "I hid in the hills for a longer time. Then I got very sick and felt very hot, and that's the last thing I remember." In other words, he ran away with nothing but the blood-covered clothes on his back, disappeared into the cold, damp winter hills near the bay, and, without realizing it, died of pneumonia. I broke the news to him, explained to him that he'd trapped himself here on Earth, and assured him that it was time for him to go on toward the light now so that he could be at peace. He shook his head, ashamed and frightened. "I can't face God. He'll never forgive me." I don't know anything about a God who never forgives, Giovanni. My God is all-loving, all-knowing, all-forgiving, and embraces every one of us who holds out our arms to him. He looked at me, taking this in. It wasn't the first time I'd met an earthbound spirit who was deliberately avoiding the tunnel and the light that would take him home because he was sure he'd done something unforgivable in God's eyes. It wouldn't be the last, either, and few things break my heart more. There's no question that sooner or later, in some lifetime or other, we have to make things right in our own souls, to balance the books spiritually when we've intentionally wronged someone. But that's because our spirits are genetically programmed ultimately to seek their highest potential and their greatest good. God doesn't see to our eventually making things right. We see to it ourselves with his guidance, his constant, patient, unwavering, unconditional love, and his powerful faith in us. I spent hours explaining that only by moving on could he free himself from the hell of guilt in which he'd imprisoned himself. At best, he'd join his wife and brother on the other side and learn that they'd forgiven him. At worst, he'd come right back to Earth in utero and spend a lifetime making amends for the lives he took. Either way was a step toward liberating himself from the awful burden he was carrying. Either way, there was hope, while the non-life he was living now held no hope at all. Finally, and with some reluctance, Giovanni agreed to go. He looked at me for one more nod of reassurance and said, "You'd better be right." With that, he disappeared. And according to subsequent phone calls and letters from John and Mary, neither he nor any other ghost ever bothered them or set foot in the slaughterhouse again. You've heard that telling ghosts they're dead and talking them over, convincing them to step into the tunnel and go toward the light, is the most effective way to get a ghost out of your house. It's also the toughest because of the many complex agendas that keep them here. If you're living with a ghost, the more you can learn about the history of your house and, of far more importance, the history of the property your house sits on, the better your chances of figuring out the identity of your ghost, what happened to him, what his point of view and agenda might be. As you've just heard in the story of the slaughterhouse, go to the light, for some ghosts, is a more terrifying prospect than the hopeless, lonely, non-existent existence they're clinging to.